winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
These have been challenging weeks for the president and the country, with the possibility of impeachment now looming for the nation's chief executive for only the fourth time in American history. New York has been at the center of many of the president's legal woes, the court cases involving Trump University, his family charity, the Trump Foundation, and the prosecution of his former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, all took place in New York State. Last month, the president's latest lawyer, William Consovoy, told the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan that the president enjoys temporary personal immunity from all prosecution, even in the case of a murder on the streets of Manhattan, as long as he lives in the White House. Meanwhile, in another federal courthouse in the Southern District of New York, the case involving hush money payments from the president to adult film actress and producer Stormy Daniels grinds on. And away from the federal judiciary, New York State Attorney General Letitia James is pursuing investigations involving the president and his family and their businesses.
I can confirm that, in fact, two civil subpoenas have been issued to Deutsche Bank and to Investors Bank, and that's all that I can say at this point in time.
Some of the legal action has involved Deutsche Bank, which has lent large sums of money to Donald Trump over the years, even when the president was close to broke or in default on other Deutsche Bank loans. Can any of this touch the president, even as he faces the possibility of impeachment? Can he be found criminally liable for anything while serving as president? Are there things state attorneys general and state governments can do that the federal government cannot, given legal precedent and the separation of powers? Joining me for this wide-ranging look at President Trump's legal troubles and how much they involve New York are Vincent Bonventre of Albany Law School and Paul Finkelman of Gratz College in Pennsylvania. And Professor Finkelman, let me start with you. Why was impeachment in the Constitution in the first place? What were the framers wrestling with about the vulnerabilities of a future chief executive that they wanted to make sure there was a way to rein one in when he, I guess they were assuming it would always be a he, went off the rails?
Well, remember, these men, and they're all men at the convention in 1787, are veterans of the revolution against King George III. They understand what happens when a chief executive, in your words, goes off the rails. They understand that if you're going to create the office of chief executive in a republic, that is, in a country where the people vote to elect their leaders, and that's really what a republic means, that you have to be able to remove the leader if the leader violates the fundamental laws of the country. Tom Paine, who writes the book Common Sense, which is the most important written work during the American Revolution, says that in America, the Constitution is king. And it's a very important point to understand. The framers understand that we are not creating a king as chief executive of the United States. We are creating a servant for the people of the United States who is obligated to follow the rules of the Constitution. So the president of the United States must take an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States of America. Military officers swear an oath not to the president of the United States, not to the chief executive, not to their commander in chief. They take an oath of office to support the Constitution of the United States. So no one is immune from the Constitution. And so when they were debating how you create the office of the president, there's almost unanimous understanding that the president can be and must be removed from office if the president fails to fulfill his obligation, which is to support and protect the Constitution. Now, the impeachment clause has particular things that are impeachable, but by implication, it's beyond that. It's failure to do what the office requires, which is to uphold and protect the Constitution in the United States.
But Professor Bonventre, like amending the Constitution itself, it was made difficult. Yes. Impeaching the chief executive is not easy under the Constitution.
That's right. And, you know, Paul's absolutely right, and especially when he talks about implications, because even though the framers were pretty clear that they wanted the chief executive, our president, not to be immune from removal like the king would be, they didn't give us much. They didn't give us much in the Constitution. So there are a couple of phrases in there, and virtually everything else has to be inferred from that. And so that's what the courts have been doing ever since the beginning of the Republic. So, yes, we know that a president can be impeached by the House of Representatives. We know that it can be removed by the Senate. And there are the terms treason, bribery, other high crimes, and misdemeanors. But there's not much more than that. I mean, you could look at the Federalist Papers, and the Federalist Papers, you know, Hamilton especially speaks about, you know, public trust, violation of the public trust, abuse of office, those kinds of things. But, you know, one of the questions today is whether or not there needs to be an actual crime. The Constitution itself doesn't tell us whether there needs to be an actual crime in order for a president to be removed. It seems as though the best we can infer is that there need not be a crime. There really must be and need only be some violation of the public trust. Then where do we go from there is, I mean, I hate to be cute, but, you know, can you count five votes on the United States Supreme Court? It all boils down to that.
Does this mean that the inferred standard, what we conclude is the standard, is different in the 1860s and the 1990s and the 1960s and then maybe about to be in the 2020s?
Well, you mean the standard for, say, Andrew Johnson?
Well, as Professor Bonventry points out, there's a lot of silence around this and inference around
it. That's right.
Is it the mores of the day that are really in charge?
Well, Gerald Ford, who was a member of Congress before he becomes vice president, before he becomes president. And remember, he becomes vice president after Richard Nixon resigns because he is not only going to be impeached.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes president after Richard Nixon resigns, and Nixon resigns because he will be both impeached and convicted. But Ford, as a congressman, said, an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives thinks an impeachable offense is. Now, I don't think that's true. I think Ford was exaggerating. But it's clear that an impeachable offense is an offense against the Constitution of the United States, against the government of the United States. It is a high crime and misdemeanor, but it is also failure to execute the office. Let me give you an example. Let us suppose that Mexico invades California, and the President of the United States says, well, California didn't vote for me, so I'm not going to defend California. I'm not sending the army to defend California from this invasion because I don't care if California falls. Now, that's not a crime. It's not technically treason because he's not aligning himself with the enemy of the United States, but it certainly is an impeachable offense. So you can't think that somehow an impeachable offense must be a criminal act, because it's not. It's an act against the essence, the central meaning of the Constitution.
Well, let's move the question now, not to impeachment, which we all agree exists as a thing. It's been exercised a couple of times in our history.
Well, it's been exercised against a number of judges.
Yeah.
And
mostly judges.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, one Secretary of War under Ulysses Grant was within hours of being voted. The House was within hours of voting to impeach him when he walks into Grant's office and says, "I'm resigning because I'm going to be impeached." And he was guilty of what they were going to impeach him for. So it normally it's not used against cabinet officers because most presidents would fire their cabinet officer before you get to the impeachment stage.
The question now, as we've watched it play out in various courtrooms, is whether and when the president is open to legal actions involving other things, not the discharge of his duties. The current letter that states Justice Department policy says, no, you can't sue the president for anything. Is that correct?
Well, You can sue the president. We know that from Clinton versus Jones, right? So President Clinton was sued by Paula Jones, and he claimed executive immunity, privilege, the whole works, right? And the Supreme Court unanimously said, no, you can be sued. A president is not above the law.
But was that a one-time only ruling on the Jones versus Clinton case? Well, or was that meant to make law for all presidents for all
time?
Well,
the Supreme Court was very clear that what we were talking about in that case was not his official acts as president. It was his conduct when he happened to have been governor of Arkansas. It becomes a completely different question if we're actually talking about a president with regard to the president's official acts, especially if we're talking about what the president has done under the cloak of diplomacy or military affairs or national security. We have not had a situation where the president has been subject to prosecution for that kind of conduct, So, for example, even in Nixon, in the Watergate tapes case, I mean, covering up the burglary didn't have to do with diplomacy. It didn't have to do with military affairs and national security. And so the United States Supreme Court, again, unanimously said, no, your executive privilege, any executive immunity you're claiming to have, doesn't apply in this particular case. And, you know, so with regard to President Trump right now, a claim I'm sure would be made that the conversations with Ukraine were a matter of diplomacy and should be included within that exception that the Supreme Court seemed clearly to be carving out in the Nixon versus, the Nixon Watergate tapes.
What about the cases that involve things other than his official duties? When he's a candidate, he pays money, which may be construed as a violation of election law, but it wasn't when he was president. You have cases involving his charity and his taxes, which grows out of charity.
You look at Clinton v. Jones, Jones is suing Clinton for activities that took place before he was president of the United States. All of the things that you started with, tax issues in New York, charities, paying off his favorite porn star to not talk, all of these things took place before he was president of the United States. Even if you could make the argument, which I don't think you can make, that the president is immune from criminal prosecution for something that took place before he was president, one could easily imagine a civil suit against Donald Trump, civilian, for tax fraud, because you can sue somebody civilly as well as, the state can go after you civilly as well as criminally for violating the tax laws, for, again, the payoff to Stormy Daniels. These things are not necessarily criminal. They could also be civil. But if they are criminal, they're criminal acts that took place before he was president of the United States. And therefore, they have absolutely nothing to do with him being president of the United States. He can't claim any kind of executive anything.
But part of the argument, both in the 90s, during the Clinton deliberations, and now under President Trump, is that a president, while running the biggest, most powerful economy and army in the world, can't be tied down like Gulliver on the beach by thousands of Lilliputians trying to tie him up in court with civil suits and criminal cases.
But the
Supreme Court rejected that in Clinton v. Jones.
This is currently Department of Justice policy. And William Consovoy went into a New York courtroom and said,
anything.
Even in the case of shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue.
Well, of course, the Constitution does not spell out this Department of Justice policy that the president can't be indicted or investigated or prosecuted for a criminal act. It doesn't say that. There are some implications that can be drawn from some of the Federalist Papers where Hamilton keeps saying afterwards, meaning after he's impeached and removed from office. But there isn't anything that actually says the president may not be prosecuted.
But which that would have to be tested in court, wouldn't
it? Yeah, and of course, and I can't wait to see what the textualists on the court who love Trump, apparently who like Trump, what they're going to say when they look at the Constitution and they're going to have to start inferring things that just aren't there, which they claim they hate to do.
And another thing is this, of course, the Justice Department position certainly might apply to the U.S. attorney because the U.S. attorney is a right. Justice Department employee. It does not apply right. to the Attorney General of the of New York State.
Right.
It does not apply to the District Attorney for Manhattan, because they are not constrained right. by whatever fantasies the Justice Department may have right. as to what can or cannot be done to the
what
President
What about
the
Southern
United
District
States?
Of New York, which is a creature of the Justice
the,
Department?
The Federal
right,
Justice
right.
Department.
And so one could imagine...
But so you can't go after him in a federal court that happens to be elsewhere.
Well, it's not clear
it's
that
not
you
clear.
Can't, but it is certainly plausible to imagine
right.
that if there were a prosecution of Donald R. Trump for tax fraud mm-hmm. in the Southern District of New York before he was president
right.
of the United States, the Attorney General would tell the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District, we are going to remove you from office and we will replace you with someone who will not pursue this because this violates Justice Department policy.
Right.
But that doesn't prevent the Justice Department from going after a number of other people and a number of other entities, including Trump's charity, including the right. Trump Organization, which always sounds like some kind of, mafia organization, the Trump Organization. It's his businesses. You could go after the corporate entities. You could certainly go after a number of his family members who are equally involved
okay.
in these things. And none of these people are immune from any federal investigation.
But in those cases where we go after institutions attached to the president, members of his family, companies that he's worked with and for, is he vulnerable to being deposed? Must he respond?
Oh, I think he's vulnerable to being deposed.
Must he be interviewed? Can he be
dragged
in as a witness against his own?
None of these are official presidential activities,
yeah. uh-huh.
right? So you don't have the argument, well, what you're doing is you're bringing criminal charges and he's got to be immune from all these lawsuits or prosecutions when he's carrying out his presidential duties, even if they turn out to be wrong.
But in those cases, when we're talking about institutions attached to the president, right. members of his family, ongoing criminal cases, civil cases, right. who can compel the president of the United States to show up in a New York courtroom to be deposed, to testify in one of these cases? Is there anybody who can force the president to do anything?
Well, of course, the United States Supreme Court could do so if you get five votes, but any federal district court judge could order the president. Whether or not the president would obey such an order is another question. But from the beginning of the Republic, federal trial judges have been ordering presidents to comply with subpoenas. In fact, one of the earliest cases, the trial of Aaron Burr, Chief Justice John Marshall, who was sitting as a circuit judge, as a trial judge, he ordered President Jefferson to come forward and to respond to a subpoena Duke has taken. He didn't get Jefferson to testify, but he ordered Jefferson. And the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly and emphatically endorsed what Chief Justice John Marshall did as a trial judge all the way back then in Aaron Burr. The wrinkle, and I think it's a really big wrinkle, you say, who can order the president to testify or even submit to a subpoena in a New York state court? I tell you, in several of these cases, the United States Supreme Court has made clear, when we are talking about the president, right, having to respond to civil litigation or having to respond to a federal subpoena in an impeachment process and a special prosecution proceeding, they made clear we are talking about a federal federal civil case. We are talking about a federal grand jury. We are talking about a federal special prosecution. And they've made clear we are not talking about a state proceeding. And I think to the extent there is any legitimacy to a president saying, well, you know, I'm going to be held down by all these different cases, I think there are several votes on the Supreme Court, I am sure, who will say, we made clear that our decisions in these past precedents do not apply to state criminal or civil proceedings.
In the 3+ minutes we have left, let's talk about what's in the president's corner, in precedent, in power, in deference. What has he got working for him, invested in his own self as president, that will allow him to fend off some of this stuff, or at least make a good run at it while he is still president of the United States?
Well, he does have, I think, some precedent and certainly some historical argument that he is immune from state prosecution on the grounds that otherwise every political figure could be up for grabs if they're passing through a state that they didn't carry in the last election.
So Attorney General James can't really go after him in the
Well, it's not clear. We don't know. But she certainly can go after civil connections to the president. And then again, there's a big difference between the civil suit and the criminal prosecution. He may be immune from criminal prosecution in the state of New York until he leaves the office. He is not immune from civil liability, even while he's president of the United States. And I think that's fairly clear. And again, one can only imagine his daughter or son-in-law being prosecuted in New York and saying, I would like to call as a witness, I would like to subpoena as a witness Donald R. Trump. Now, does Daddy Trump not show up to be a witness in the criminal prosecution of a family member? I think that would be a very interesting moment. But once he walks in, of course, he can't say, oh, but I'm not answering any cross-examination. Once he's there, he's there. So I think these things get to be very, very interesting, because the framers could never have imagined the kind of tentacles of a family all involved in the president's businesses and all involved in the president's political maneuverings in the way we have them today. None of the framers, I think, in their greatest fear, in their worst nightmare, could have imagined this kind of situation.
Well, we have just under a minute left. Can he play out the clock for as long as he's president, sort of dodge and weave, use procedural clutching up the gears?
Well, he can certainly play out the clock, I think, until election time. But, you know, Nixon got reelected. He got reelected in a landslide, and then what happened? 2 years later, he's out, right? He resigns. Ray, the fact of the matter is, I think we can boil all this down to, they're constitutional issues. Why? Because they're not settled. Most of this stuff is not settled. That's why they're issues. And I don't care what some of the justices say when they're writing these opinions, and they will sound like these things are certain. They're not certain. None of this stuff is really, well, some of the things Paul said are certain, but other than that, most of the big stuff is just not clear at all.
One more thing. The justices, at least most of them, have a sense of history.
Yes.
They have a sense of how they are going to be remembered.
And that may be our saving grace.
And that may be the saving grace. Yeah. I would expect that if there is an opinion ordering Donald Trump to do something he doesn't want to do, it will be written by Chief Justice Roberts. And the chief will say, I am writing this opinion, and he will probably get most or all of the Supreme Court to back him. And in this sense, I think the Supreme Court has a much better sense of its place in history than, say, the former mayor of New York.
Bonventry concurs.
Professors, To be continued. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us for this special episode of New York Now. We'll see you next week.